May it please the court, Ms. Moraleda. My name is Jane Hazen, attorney registration number 7474, and I'm pleased to be here to argue this case on behalf of Shannon Berry this afternoon. I hope that the court finds this case as interesting as I do. There appear to be two societal interests that were in conflict in the trial court, and it's Mr. Berry's position that if the statute had been applied correctly, there would have been no conflict. The first interest is that society needs to protect its judges from intimidation and from retaliation. There's no question about that. Mr. Berry does not challenge the need for this statute. The second societal interest is that we want people who are suffering from mental distress, who are in a psychiatric crisis, to feel free to seek professional help. And that is exactly what Mr. Berry did. He went to the emergency room in crisis, begged his friend to take him. She said, "You're drunk, sleep it off, you'll be okay in the morning." But his family and his friends had been ignoring him for weeks and months, and he knew that the thoughts that he was having were pathological. They weren't healthy, and he said, "No, take me to the emergency room." When he got there, we do not know exactly what he said. We don't have a tape recording. We don't have direct quotes. We have nurses' notes. We have Dr. Rhonda Niederhauser, who was a psychologist who came in to evaluate him, and she paraphrased what he had to say. He did say that he was unhappy and that he felt like killing people, and when she asked who, he said it was ex-wife, her divorce attorney, the judge in the divorce case. When she questioned him further, she determined that under Colorado statute 1321.117, she had a situation which required that she take action. And what that statute requires is that action be taken if a mental health worker perceives that there is a serious threat of imminent physical violence against specific persons. The mental health worker is given several options. She chose to exercise all three that are outlined in the statute, and we don't question her judgment in that in this appeal. However, the problem came in when the prosecutors determined that because she had perceived a serious threat of imminent physical violence, that it was necessarily a true threat under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution and Colorado Constitution guarantees of free speech. The prosecutors didn't look any more carefully at the statements that Mr. Berry made and the context in which he made them. First Amendment jurisprudence.
Well, could I stop you? I'm sorry to interrupt because this is a very fascinating case. Yes. The question that I had was the mental state knowingly. Okay?
Yes.
An individual commits retaliation against a judge by means of a credible threat. One, if the individual knowingly makes the credible threat to another person, if the other person is required by statute or ethical to rule to report the communication to the judge. Is that what you're talking about here?
I'm talking about that in part, in the second part of my argument.
But you're going to talk about the mental state?
Yeah. In terms of it being overbroad.
I'm talking about what is the mental state? Does the defendant have to know that the mandated reporter would make a report?
That is a position that we take in terms of the deficiency in the jury instructions. There's two points that on which we find fault with the jury instructions. One is based on People v. Hickman, that in order to...
I don't want to get into jury instructions yet, because I'm guessing that's what you're going to address in the second part. I'm talking about just the mental state.
I think that, well...
In other words, if a defendant says something to a third person, knowing that third person is going to go tell the judge, for example, that would be... fall under the A, and in this case, because it's a mandated reporter, would the defendant have to know that person has to make a report, thereby ultimately it will reach the judge?
Yes. It's our position that the person should be warned that that's a possibility when they're talking to a mandatory reporter.
But they should have the mental state of being aware that that person will make the report.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because that's a sufficiency argument, and that seems to be interwoven within your constitutional argument.
That's true.
But that's a sufficiency in and of itself.
Yes.
And was there evidence in any way suggesting this defendant knew the reporter would make a report?
No. In fact, she specifically testified. I did not, with my private therapy clients, I tell them confidentiality has limits. If you make threats, if you report sexual abuse of children, abuse of the elderly, confidentiality doesn't apply. She testified specifically that she's not required to do that in the emergency room, and that she does not do it in the emergency room because it would put a damper on her being able to establish a connection with these people.
So was there any evidence suggesting the defendant knew this was a reporter who would make a report?
The only thing in the record that indicated that he didn't know until after he made the statement, after he explained to her.
Okay, but I'm talking about before. No, I don't care about after.
No, I looked. I could find nothing in the record that showed that before he talked to her, he knew that she would be under an obligation to report his statements.
And it's your position that that is the requirement under this statute, that that's the mental state, the awareness the reporter would report?
I think it should be, yes. But it wasn't under the jury instructions.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, and let's see if I do. First, it is that the evidence as a matter of law is insufficient for conviction.
That's correct.
Okay. Secondly, assuming that the evidence was sufficient for conviction, there was a prejudicial instructional error.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Was there a motion to dismiss made by defense counsel in the trial court?
Yes.
Okay, so that issue presumably was preserved. It was based upon the argument that the circumstances here were such that there was no evidence as to the knowledge of the defendant with respect to the duty of the person whom he's speaking to report.
Yes, it was framed as a First Amendment argument that this was not a true threat, that this man had a right to go to the emergency room and tell the psychologist what was on his mind, and that by prosecuting him, his First Amendment rights were being.
My question is this: was the issue of the requirement of knowing the duty of the person to report a basis for the motion to dismiss?
No.
Does that make a difference in our review of that issue?
That issue has to be reviewed under a plain error standard, Your Honor, because no alternate jury instructions were presented and there was no objection.
All right. Is the issue of sufficiency of the evidence reviewed under a plain error standard or otherwise?
with regard to the first point that we're making, that it's overbroad as applied, there is...
Let's not talk about the constitutionality. Let's talk about sufficiency of the evidence. And my question is simply this. In a claim of insufficiency of the evidence to convict, do we review that issue when the argument was not made at the trial court under a plain error standard or some other standard?
The defendant moved to dismiss based upon the fact that the statute was not being interpreted correctly, and therefore there was insufficient evidence to convict him if it was a proper if it had been interpreted properly.
Well, but counsel didn't even object to the instruction, which did not refer to the mens rea of knowingly with respect to the obligation of the person whom he was speaking to report.
That's correct, and so it would be a plain.
So was that issue raised at the trial level?
No, it was not.
So is it plain error that we're looking at, or some other standard? Do you know? I don't. That's why I'm asking the question.
I think it's plain error when it comes to our objections to the jury instructions, because there was no objection made to that.
I think you and I agree on that. My question is the sufficiency of the evidence a plain error review?
And I guess maybe I'm not understanding you. What you're saying is that the sufficiency of the evidence is the way that you're approaching our claim that it was unconstitutional as applied, because Justice Mularkey in the Janusik opinion indicated that that's how we should treat overbroad as applied, by analyzing it as sufficiency of the evidence. And is that what you're getting at? I'm just trying to...
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that however you phrase it, you can phrase it, I suspect, constitutionally, or otherwise simply saying that the evidence was not sufficient to convict under the statute. But I won't pursue the point further. I'm just questioning whether the sufficiency of the evidence is a plain error review standard. I don't know.
Well, the interpretation of the statute is de novo.
Of course.
And whether it was a true threat versus protected speech was a question for the jury. And it was raised by the defendant prior to trial, at halftime, and after the trial, saying this was insufficient evidence to convict because you're looking at the statute incorrectly. You're not seeing that this was protected speech. And when the First Amendment concerns are implicated, this court has an obligation to make an independent review of the record as a whole. It's a slightly higher standard than simply reviewing sufficiency of the evidence under People versus Bennett.
But is it your assertion that it is constitutionally improper for a conviction to be based upon a statement to a person who is required to report, assuming that the person advises the speaker before any statement is made that if you make a threat, I have to report?
I don't think that's unconstitutional, but I think it's unconstitutional
okay.
when the client didn't know.
All right.
Does that, am I understanding you now? Turning to our constitutional challenge under the First Amendment, in looking at true threats, there's three factors. Courts look at the literal language, and they look at the context, and they also look at the reaction of the recipients. Under an objective standard, is it reasonable that this was really a threat? And those first two factors are the ones that are critical here, because the literal language used by Mr. Berry in the emergency room was for the most part conditional. Why are you here? I'm having these crazy thoughts that I want to kill people. I want to kill people, not I'm going to kill people. When the police came for him the very next day before the sedative had worn off, he said, I didn't say I was going to kill them. I said I wanted to kill them. His language was, if you let me go, I'll hurt someone. He was there specifically to get help. This is not a man who was dragged out of a bar drunk and is making all kinds of allegations and threats and everything. He specifically came, help me with these thoughts. I know that they're wrong thoughts. And that leads us to the context. He was in an emergency room. He was seeking a psychological evaluation and help. He was saying, please help me deal with these thoughts. And the cases that I could find in the country which dealt with threats being made during the initial psychological evaluation or in the brief, two of the Military Court of Appeals cases, Cotton and Wright, and the third is out of the state of Washington, State v. Shaler. Now, the military cases are persuasive only because they weren't interpreting the First Amendment. But both appellate judges found in those cases that when a person goes in psychological crisis, is speaking to medical personnel, it is a genuine attempt to get help, that those statements cannot be held as wrongful, as illegal. You have a right to seek help, to try to solve your problem. We want people to get help. In State v. Shaler, the conviction was reversed because there was no instruction given on true threats. And they said that had an instruction been given, then the jury could have determined, well, was this a true threat that he was going to go after the neighbors? Or was this his cry for help because he was in the emergency room for hours?
Well, there was no objection made. There was no instruction in this case telling the jury what a threat was there?
No. There was credible threat. I'm sorry.
There was an instruction on credible threat.
Yes.
Are you saying that the statutory definition of credible threat, which is incorporated into the statute, doesn't meet the constitutional standard to satisfy a true threat? Is that what you're saying to us?
What I'm saying to you
is that the credible threat statute, therefore, is unconstitutional?
I am not saying that at all. I think that as far as it goes, the credible threat definition was just fine. The problem is that nobody down in the trial court read People versus Hickman, in which Justice Bender, in interpreting retaliation against a witness statute, which had been changed by the legislature, the word intentionally had been left out. And he said by its very nature, retaliation, intimidation, extracting retribution is specific intent. And we're going to read it into this statute. If the people down in the trial court had read that, they would have realized that they needed to give an instruction that Mr. Berry, when he made his statements, had to have an intent to retaliate against the judge.
So that's a different argument, as I understand it. There is an absence of a mention of specific intent in instruction number 11, which seems to be required by Hickman. So that's a different argument,
Mickey? That is, Your Honor.
All right, but again, there was no objection to the instruction.
I see you're out of time, but you can go ahead and answer the questions.
Was no objection.
So we have to review that for plain error.
Plain error and substantial rights to the defendant.
And the statute had never been interpreted. We're supposed to find this was plain error.
Correct, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Carmen Moraleda, and I represent the people in this matter. My attorney registration is 34852. I would like to begin answering Judge Criswell's question as to the sufficiency of the evidence. The sufficiency of the evidence has like a kind of independent, it's an independent standard.
I thought.
The standard is whether when reviewing the evidence as a whole and in the light most favorable to the prosecution, a reasonable person could conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty of the offense, again, beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's independent for the plain error standard.
And it does, where there's is no objection made based upon the insufficiency of the evidence at the trial level, do we review based upon the standard that we normally use for plain error?
Your Honor's sufficiency of the evidence question do not need to be raised or preserved. Normally, the trial court, the appellate court reviews on the sufficiency of the evidence. It doesn't need to be raised, preserved.
That was my understanding.
So
thank you.
Despite the fact there may have been no motion to dismiss on the lack of knowledge of the defendant that whatever her name was a reporting person, he can still raise it on appeal as a sufficiency of the evidence claim, assuming that such knowledge is required under the statute.
I don't think I understand your question. I think the sufficiency of the evidence before this court is only whether the defendant made credible threats. That's the only issue that is properly before this court, because it's my position that the remaining issues on appeal are not properly before this court, either because they were not raised in the trial court or because they had it raised for the first time in the reply. And specifically, I refer to the challenges to the constitutionality of the retaliation against the judge statute that was not raised in the trial court and is not properly for this court. The second challenge I'm referring to is the defendant's contention that his communications to the psychologist were privileged. That has been raised for the first time in the reply brief. Regardless, there is a case from the division of this court that has concluded that the duty to warn prevails over any privilege. And that's, I think it's McCarthy v. Kaiser Hill.
Counsel, the question though that's presented here is, in order to determine whether there was a sufficiency of the evidence, we would have to necessarily decide what the statute requires, right?
Yes.
And if the statute requires, for example, that the defendant know that the person to whom he's making the statement has a duty to report, and if the evidence of the record is insufficient to establish that, isn't that an insufficiency of the evidence issue?
I don't think so. I think the sufficiency of the evidence is only as to the threats, whether the threats were credible or not. The other issue are constitutional issues.
Well, sorry to interrupt, because I'm stuck on what I asked a while ago of opposing counsel. Mm-hmm. What is the mental state if we look at subsection B, quote, if the other person is required by statute or ethical rule to report the communication to the judge? What's the mental state? Does the defendant have to know the reporter would report?
Our position is that two mental states. The threats, the credible threats, have to be made knowingly, which just requires that the person making the threats is aware that he's making the threats. He doesn't have to have the...
aware making the threats just threat, or does he have to know that threat would reach the judge some way, maybe indirectly or intentionally through a third person?
Your Honor, there are two sections. One of them requires that, so the threat, the credible threat be made, you know, committed upon the judge, either directly to the judge or to a third person.
We're on the third person piece.
Yes, that the third person, if the
introduction modifies all that with the word knowingly, right, which is what Judge Furman is trying to get to. Does knowingly modify the second part of that, which is they have to know that the other person is required by statute or rule to report the communication. Does knowingly modify subparagraph B? That's our question.
My position is that it does not.
Why not?
Because it's already covered under Section A, that the person intends that if it communicates to a third person, that that third person is going to communicate.
So it's
that.
A specific intent?
The specific intent is the retaliation part.
Well,
the threats have to be made.
A says if the individual intended that the communication would be relayed to the judge. So that's a specific intent. That's intending what I say gets to the judge.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now we're on B, where there's no identified mental state.
Exactly. My position there is that just the threat be made knowingly, and it only what? By the fact.
Yeah, what's he have to know?
He have to know. That's what we're trying to get at.
He's aware that he's making statements.
Yes,
he's does he have to know those statements would somehow reach the judge, perhaps directly under A or indirectly through a reporter going to whoever the reporter goes to?
Under A, he will know, I mean, he has to know that the communication, because that was his intent, that the communication would be relayed. But under B, it doesn't have, I think what the generosity was trying to get is that under the circumstances where a person has a duty to report, a duty to warn, then it doesn't matter whether the person making the threat knows that that person has that duty to report.
If somebody says something to a psychologist, we assume that's protected communication. We certainly have many statutes talking about that. So if he's making these statements to a psychologist, assuming for the purpose of getting help, you're saying it's a bit of strict liability almost, that because the psychologist will report it to the judge, we don't have to link the mental state to that, the defendant knowing that would happen.
Your Honor, as to the privilege of the communication, so that a division of this court has specifically concluded that the duty to warn trumps the privilege.
And I'm not too interested in the privilege piece. I'm just on basic mental status, the mental state of the defendant.
So if you could repeat the last question again,
would the legislature want this conduct prohibited? In other words, if a defendant sits down with a psychologist and makes a threat, not knowing the reporter would report, how is that a crime?
How is that a crime?
Whereas if he sits down with a mandated reporter with a psychologist, knowing the psychologist will tell this to the judge, I think that would be a crime. But that's what's not clear, because the statute doesn't give that under this part B.
Your Honor, it happens that the person makes a credible threat. That's a factual question, a determination for the jury.
Counsel, the what determination? Determination that he knew or didn't know?
That he made a credible threat.
Well, he had access to a gun, and he said maybe something about killing a judge. But what's the context of the threat? Does he have to know that would reach the judge in some way?
I don't think so. There's a statute, and he doesn't say may. He said, "I want to kill my wife. I want to kill the judge. I want to kill the attorney for the divorce." When the psychologist asked,
that was in response to a question.
Actually not at the beginning. When he came in the emergency room, he told the emergency nurses, "I'm gonna quote: patient threatening to kill someone if you let me go. Patient threatening to kick." Patient states he wants to kill anyone, has access to gun, wants to hurt people. And then when he met with a psychologist, he reaffirmed, yes, he wanted to kill the dad, the wife. He reaffirmed when the psychologist asked, well, I spoke with your wife. And she said that she doesn't think you're serious. She thinks you're just intoxicated. And he said, well, and I'm quoting, I think she's stupid for not thinking that I can actually go ahead and do it.
Oh, so let me ask you this question. Doesn't the very nature of a threat require that the person threatened know about it? For example, if I'm out in the desert and there's no one within 10 miles of me and I say I'm going to kill so-and-so, that's no threat, is it?
If there's no one there?
Yes.
It's no threat.
There's no one here. So doesn't the very nature of a threat indeed require that the person threatened know about it?
Okay.
Just a second. And doesn't the statute imply that? In fact, it says you make a threat in one of two ways. You can make it either directly, not clearly the person knows about it then, mm-hmm. or you can make it to someone who you intend report it to someone, mm-hmm. that makes a communication, or you make it to someone with a duty to report. Now the question is, do you have to know in order to make a threat that the person to whom you're speaking is going to report it to the judge?
And I don't think so, Your Honor. And let me ask you a question. Whether a threat is credible, courts use an objective standard. The critical inquiry is whether the person hearing or listening that threat reasonably believes that the threat is an actual threat.
It's not a threat unless the person is going to report it, right? Whether it's under a duty to report or not, it's not a threat unless the individual speaking intends that the person to whom he's speaking is going to communicate that to the person threatened.
I don't think that you need that intent. I don't think you need to know that the person, you need to know that person has a duty to report. And the other thing, Your Honor, is there's a presumption
to a non-reporting person, the statute clearly requires that intent.
Can you repeat the question?
Yes, if it's to a non-mandatory reporter, as we mm-hmm. came to call them, clearly the statute requires that intent, because it says if you make it to another person, if the individual intends the communication to be relayed. Clearly, if it's to a third party, the intent has to be that it be relayed. So why wouldn't you infer similarly for a so-called mandatory reporter, knowledge on the person on the part of the defendant that the mandatory person has to report it? Isn't it only logical to read that symmetry into the statute?
Well, maybe because the general assembly was trying to cover another situation where a person, I think that was part of the legislative history of the statute, where someone was to a psychologist and talks about and makes these threats. And they wanted to cover that situation.
Yeah, sure.
To protect the judge.
Sure. And if the psychologist, as Ms. Hazen suggested, tells the person at the get-go, I'm going to report this if you, whatever you say, then the person knows that there's a mandatory reporter. And if the person makes a threat, so be it. That's a crime. But if it's not told at the outset that that's a mandatory reporter, he goes to the ER and he doesn't really know who he's talking to, is there some requirement that he, ought there not to be a requirement that he know? I mean, that's the question that the judges here are struggling with. Let me ask you another question off on this different subject, okay? You seem to say in your brief that specific intent is required that this be a person, that this be a threat for purposes of retaliation or retribution. You agree with that specific intent requirement, right?
Yes, sir.
I don't see in Instruction 11 any requirement of specific intent, as I asked Ms. Hazen. Is it your position that we, that's not error in this case, or that that's only plain error in this case that we should look at?
Two things, Your Honor. I agree that the instruction does not specifically use the words in retaliation or retribution. However, if you look at, I think it's element number four, the instruction requires or explains to the jury that the credible threat has to be made against a judge who has served in a legal matter involving the defendant. And that language implicitly requires that the credible threats be made in response to the judge's ruling, and that ruling be the base of the credible threats.
But again, the statute has two different aspects, right? It says in the introductory paragraph that threat has to be made as retaliation or retribution against the judge, and then later it says a judge who has served in a legal matter. In other words, it's not retaliation. If the judge doesn't serve in a legal matter, it could be it's not retaliation under this statute, even if it was thought to be retaliation. My point is, you do agree that specific intent's required. The jury instruction did not specifically include specific intent as a requirement.
Okay, yes, no. But I said that
number four satisfies that.
And the other, this is during the vehicle plain error, which requires affects substantial right, and the record reveals the reasonable probability that it contributed to the conviction. Here, it was not disputed at trial that the threats were made in retaliation. The focus was whether the statements were credible threats.
Well, counsel, certainly the question of whether he intended to kill was an issue in the case.
I see you're out of time, but you can go ahead and respond.
What wasn't his claim at the trial is that he wasn't intending to kill, that he was there to seek help because he had these thoughts. So it wasn't the question of specific intent, perhaps the most prime issue in the case.
The focus of the case was whether the threats were credible. He was saying that it was a description of his mental state, not credible threats.
And didn't that involve the issue of specific intent?
I don't think so. It was just the credible threat determination.
Okay.
And the evidence otherwise was overwhelming that the threats is because of the rulings, Judge Dubois rulings in the divorce case. I think I'm out of time. I would like to request that this court affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and the written opinion will issue in due course. We'll take a short